There's two seats up here. There's one seat up here. If you've got a seat beside you, please raise your hand. There we go. Thank you. That was really hard.
Silent. It should still record, right?
Yeah, it should. I believe so.
Okay.
I think it should.
Okay.
Sounds good to me. I'm at paint. Excellent job, Shane.
I raised the high bar.
Yeah. All right. Good evening and welcome to the Wall Big Book Group of Cocaine Anonymous. My name is Sydney and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sydney.
For those who would like, please join us in a 4-minute meditation. All right. There are two seats still up here if anyone needs one. Cocaine Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other so we may solve our common problem and help others recover from addiction. While the name Cocaine Anonymous may sound drug-specific, we wish to assure you that our fellowship is not. Many of our members did a lot of cocaine, others used only a little, and some none at all. We have members who drank moderately and others who are real alcoholics. According to CA's third tradition, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using cocaine and all other mind-altering substances. With this all-inclusive tradition, CA welcomes anyone with a drug or alcohol problem. CA's 12 steps are not drug-specific. If you have a desire to stop using mind-altering substances for good and all, you are welcome here. In this group, we recognize the significance of AA's three legacies: recovery, unity, and service, which signify the three sides of the triangle in the circle and triangle symbol. This symbol has ancient spiritual roots and represents mind, body, and spirit together as one. We have been not only mentally and bodily ill, we have also been spiritually sick. We have a threefold program designed to treat a threefold illness. If actions are taken in all three areas, we will recover and experience mental, physical, and spiritual wholeness. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous outlines the program of action. Our group studies the book and the mechanics of working the steps the first and third Tuesdays of the month. We rotate the monthly facilitator's responsibilities among our home group members. For the first 30 minutes, the facilitator shares his or her experience with the pages we cover each meeting. Then we open up the second half of the meeting for sharing. We ask that shares consist of your experience with the pages covered and are limited to 3 minutes. To ensure the time limit is respected, we use a timer. The facilitator may interject after each share if he or she so chooses. The second Tuesday of the month is our discussion meeting. The month's Big Book study facilitator will choose a topic from the Big Book and share his or her personal experience for 10 minutes. Then we open the meeting and observe the same sharing guidelines that were mentioned earlier. Finally, on the fourth Tuesday of the month, we ask a member of Cocaine Anonymous to share his or her personal story of recovery and transformation. Tonight, Tom is going to come up and introduce tonight's speaker.
Tom.
Hey, Tom.
I could sit up for about 3 hours and talk about this kid, but, you know, he asked me to introduce him yesterday. I said, yeah, man. I turned around, I walked off, and I started crying. I go back to when I was about a year or two sober. And this guy got up to introduce somebody, give him a chip, whatever, and he began to cry. And I was like, man, you didn't man up, dog. Wuss. And I understood that yesterday, and you know how important it is to get up here and tell your story in this group. And I mean, I don't even know who Danielle is, but apparently she spoke recently, and I just heard all these guys for 2 weeks talking about the power of her story and how it affected their lives. I got to hear Frank's story last week. And the guy walked up to me and said, man, that was powerful. That was about transformation. I could listen to him for another 2 hours. When people get up there to tell their stories and bare our souls in this room, it's scary. And this guy's never backed away from it. I knew him when he was out there. I kept running into him all over the freaking city of Birmingham. We weren't ever sober. We'd even be in Jemison Circle K. I'm buying some dip, and he comes walking in all geeked up. And, guess you're having fun. He weighs about $1.20. But he came in. And I'm going to say two things. He did the work. He was not scared of the work. He headed straight into it, and he did it with everything he had. He's helped me grow tremendously in being straight up honest with me, and I respect him and I listen to him. And he's got a powerful story of transformation. But the one thing he's done is he's begun to let God write his story. The only thing about him that cracks me up more than anything is his transformation is so big that when he walks into a room, people just look at him and go, holy crap, what happened to him? He doesn't even have to talk yet, right? And he has that presence because he knew so many people out there. He's got a fantastic story. He's got a lot of hope. Y'all, here comes Andrew.
drug addict.
Amen.
I don't know who y'all thought was speaking tonight. There's a lot of people here. Man, I just want to say, because it's on my mind, like, I feel ridiculous in this suit. I feel like I should be going to court. But, you know, my sponsor tells me, you know, I come from a lineage that thinks that this is important. You know, it's official business, and so we show up that way. I still think that part of it is to kind of trick y'all about the kind of person that's speaking to y'all tonight. But, you know, I appreciate that, Tom. You know, he was one of the people that really, when I was still out there, you know, that I would think about. You know, because I had been around the rooms for a long time, more out than in, but I'd come around, and when I was out there, you know, I would find myself thinking about people that I'd met in here, you know, and that something else was possible, and he has one of those presences like he was talking about. You know, I knew that he wasn't just talking about it. He was living it, and, you know, I'm glad that our paths have continued to cross. You know, I never know how these things are going to go. I got off my sponsor called me right before we came in here, and he just reminded me of something on page 29. It says, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. And, you know, that's not always easy for me to do. You know, I'm the youngest of four children, and, you know, my mom was an alcoholic, and I started using and drinking at a pretty young age, and I did it my entire adult life, up until really not very long ago. And, like, a lot happened. You know, I can't fit all of that into an hour, into 45 minutes. So trying to figure out what's important and what's not, like, I never do a good job at it. But understand, or trying to explain the way that I built a relationship with God is, it's easier and it's harder than telling my whole life story. So like I said, I'm the youngest of four children. My mom was a very bad alcoholic. And, you know, that affected me. I didn't realize that until, you know, later on. You know, I'm going to say a lot of things tonight that I realize now. I did not realize it when it was going on. You know, there were things that were driving me and were influencing the way that I showed up in relationships, the way I showed up as an employee, that I didn't understand what was going on. You know, and like I said, that's why I bring that up, because, you know, my mom was a closet drinker, right? So she was a school teacher. She would go to school. She'd take a 20-ounce water bottle full of vodka with her to teach first grade, which I respected. and then she would come home, and she would, you know, she'd have a half gallon of Smirnoff in the bedroom closet, and she would go in there, and she would close the door, and she wouldn't come out. And, you know, I didn't know that that wasn't the way that things were supposed to be. You know, and then my dad would come home and she'd come out and they'd fight and argue. I was never abused. I was never neglected. I never missed a meal. But it was a dysfunctional home. You know, me and my parents, particularly my mother, were very distant. You know, and my dad was left kind of picking up the slack. You know, he had four kids and an alcoholic wife. You know, so he was gone a lot. And so I basically grew up in a house full of teenagers. All my siblings are significantly older than me. And I just kind of got used to doing what I wanted to do. You know, I went to school. Wasn't an issue for me. You know, I somewhat excelled academically with very little effort. Because if it had required effort, I guarantee you I would not have done very well. But I never really was able to connect to people. You know, there's this line that's been, you know, I've been thinking about what I was going to talk about all week, and this line out of the 12 and 12 and the 4-step talks about the primary fact we fail to realize is our total inability to form a true partnership with another human being. You know, and that is what I suffered from a very, very young age. I just always had this feeling that if you knew who I was, that you wouldn't like me. You know, and that was with the people that I went to school with. You know, to a certain extent, it was with my own family. You know, we had bonds and connections and we had fun together, but it was always very surface level. And I had to come in here to learn how to get past that. I really, really did. And so there was always this disconnect. And I grew up in a very religious household. It was expected, you know, no matter what you did on Saturday night, you know, your ass is going to be in church on Sunday morning. And, you know, that was fine. I'm grateful for that today. But what it did is it kind of enforced that idea that I had that, like, if you really knew what was going on, then shit is not cool, you know? So my parents end up getting divorced, and my mom left. She was from Montana, and she moved back out there, and she was out of my life basically from age 6 or 7 till I was about 18. And my dad remarried a couple years later to a wonderful woman that's my stepmom now. I'm so grateful for her. You know, I really, really am, because I needed structure and a mother and like all of these things that I really wasn't used to. You know, I wasn't a bad kid, but I just, you know, I didn't have that. And so he married this woman who, you know, he was doing pretty well financially at the time, and so she didn't have to work. She stayed at home. So I went from basically not ever having any kind of adult authority figure in the house to having one there all the time. And that was an adjustment. It was an adjustment. What it did is it made me real sneaky. because I'm not going to go from doing what I want to do to not doing what I want to do. So that's what happened. But things, you know, my siblings all got older and moved out and got families and lives and all that stuff. And I was kind of left on my own, you know. My family was there, but I just didn't know how to connect to them. You know, in a lot of ways, it was like strangers living in the same house. And I didn't know how to get past that. I really, really didn't. And so fast forward, I get to high school. Well, actually, one other thing, because I feel like it's important. So I saw what alcohol had done to my family, you know. And my stepmom that my dad married had 3 adult drug addict alcoholic children. So I heard, I had the information growing up, like, hey, you know, might want to watch out. And so I had made a decision at an early age that I wasn't going to drink because I saw what it did to my mother. So I get to high school, and I was like 14, and I was hanging out with this girl. Yeah, and her name was Miranda. And one day, she was an older woman. And one day she put these 2 blue and white, well, white with these blue speck pills in my hand. Yeah, y'all know what I'm talking about. Yeah, and it really didn't, she said, you want some of these? I said, absolutely. Yeah. Dude, I want to do whatever you want me to do. And I took them, we were at school and I took them. And about 30, 45 minutes later, something amazing happens. You know, that separate, different, and alone feeling that I talked about completely disappeared. You know, I was taller, I was better looking, I was funny. I was able to say all these things because I like to think I'm a funny guy, you know. But back then, like growing up, I was shy, you know. I didn't know how to say this stuff and, you know, not be weird. And I found myself saying things that I'd never said in my life, you know, and people were laughing, and I was a part of the group. You know, what I felt was connection for probably the first time in my life. And I still remember I was in trade school. I took this like graphic design or some bullshit. And I went and sat down. Everybody else was already working, and I came in late, you know, because I'm high. And I sat down, and I did my work, and I sent it in. And, you know, a few minutes later, my teacher calls me in there. She says, "This is the best work you've ever done." Damn right it is. Yeah. And I had a spiritual experience with opiates. You know, there's this guy, Adam T, that talks about, you know, he did all of these substances and realized later that the whole time that's what he was looking for was a spiritual experience. And I had that. And it planted a seed in my mind that, like, this is something that I can use to be able to function and be a normal human being, you know, because I'd never felt that before. You know, I always felt that separate, different, and alone. If you knew me, you wouldn't like me. And so I didn't just immediately get strung out. You know, it didn't take long, but, you know, I would just binge for a while. You know, I became a bathroom cabinet bandit, you know. Every time I go to somebody's house, I got to use the bathroom, you know, see what you got up there. And, you know, I'd always kind of hung out with older people, and I got, you know, we have this ability to find people like us, you know, and I found that. And my priorities started to change a lot very quickly. You know, I wanted to party, you know, and chase women and do all the stuff that we do. And so it wasn't a daily thing immediately, but I would say I was 14 the first time. By the time I was, you know, 16, 17, I was starting to experience like withdrawals and things like that. I didn't know what it was. And so, like, to give you a little frame of reference, I went into my senior year ranked like number 4 in my class, all right? But my addiction is progressing, right? So I graduated 21st. And I decided that I was going to take a summer off college before I went to college. It's been a long summer. So I got it. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, my parents, I come from hardworking, working class people. You know, my dad was dyslexic, you know, and he kind of got where he was in his career and a lot of positions that he never should have been able to get those jobs from, working hard and showing up and doing that kind of stuff. And so that was instilled in me, right? And he's like, "Well, if you're not going to college, you know, you're getting a job." You know, I'd already had jobs, but like now you're doing it all the time, right? And so y'all know how this goes. You know, I started working in some automotive manufacturing plants. I don't know if any of y'all have ever done work like that, but everybody's fucked up all the time. It's the only way that you can do that kind of work. And so once again, you know, I fell in with people like me. And I had been taking a lot of pills for a couple years at this point. And you know how this progresses. You know, I just happened to be around some people that were using needles, you know, a couple months after I graduated high school. And I had never thought that that was something that I would do. Although growing up, like, all my role models were heroin addicts. So, like, I was, you know, I really love music and musicians, and that's kind of a thing. So I was introduced to the needle, and shit got real fast. You know, I started shooting Roxy's, and that didn't go on very long. That's a very, very expensive habit, and more than you make fucking slinging seats for Volkswagen. Yeah. And so once again, you know, my priorities start to shift and I have to do more and more to stay high. I start getting in trouble. And by this time, you know, I had moved out of my parents' house, and then I had to move back in my parents' house in a very short amount of time. And, you know, they're kind of starting to realize, like, there's something going on here, you know. And they gave me the benefit of the doubt for as long as they could. You know, kind of a side note, I made amends to my stepmom a couple months ago. And that was one of the things that she told me is, you know, she said, you had everybody else fooled. And I had never thought about that before. You know, not only, you know, her and my dad got married when I was 10. And I started shooting heroin at 18. So, and shit got real bad by the time I was about 20. And I never thought about that. Not only did she have to watch this person that she cared about very, very much go through some very hard things, on top of that, I alienated her from the rest of her family. You know, that's not what I was trying to do. You know, I just didn't know how to live. I didn't know how to deal with all the stuff that was going on in my head. And I did Roxy's for a couple months, and I was introduced to heroin. I started doing heroin because it was an economic decision, really. You know, inflation and all that. And the first time I did it, I had another one of those experiences like I talked about where, you know, it wasn't the highest I had ever been or anything like that, but I did some because some people I was with had some, and I remember doing it and asking them, I'm like, how much do you think that costs? They're like, I don't know, $10. And I was like, I need you to call that guy back. I need some more of this, right? And that was good for a little while. The problem is, you know, if it's cheaper, it just means I buy more. Like, that's how that works for me. And so, you know, my tolerance goes up. I'm getting to the point where I can't go to work, you know, if I don't have anything. And so I start losing jobs, and then I have to commit crimes. And you know, that's just how it goes. And so I landed in treatment the first time at 19. It was not because I wanted to get sober. It was because I had gotten involved in the criminal justice system and I could not pass a drug test. Well, I could until I couldn't, you know. And then on top of that, my family kind of knew what was up and they gave me an ultimatum. And I was like, you know what, I'm kind of tired. You know, I'll go lay down, get my weight up, you know, for another run. I didn't realize that's what I was doing, but that's what I was doing. And so I went to a place over in the West End because I didn't have health insurance or money. And while I was in there, well, for one, I got high while I was in there. You know, and I left there. And my parents had been involved in Al-Anon for quite a few years at this time, not because of me, but it didn't benefit me any. I really felt like I was robbed of a lot of good years of enabling. So while I'm in there, they're like, by the way, you're not coming home. So I went to another state-funded facility that's kind of like a halfway house. And I kind of realized, like, I'm not done getting high, but I do kind of need to get my life together. And so I got high that one time in detox, and I'm like, this is a good chance I got here. I need to get a job, you know. I need to get a car because I totaled the last one. You know, I need to, the girl's kind of upset at me, you know, all those things. And so I'd made a decision like, okay, I'm gonna chill out for a little while. I think I lasted 3 days before I was shooting heroin in the room. And, you know, I just thought it's because I wanted to get high. I didn't realize till much, much later that I was compelled to do that, that I didn't have a solution. I didn't know that it was, I kind of knew it was my solution. That went on, you know, I'm not going to go through all my treatment attempts. I've been to treatment 15 times. That doesn't count psych wards because I use those like a fucking hotel, you know. Like, if I get tired, you know, go lay down. I'm suicidal. You know, it's been a long, long road. But looking back, like all of those attempts, even though I wasn't ready, like seeds were planted. You know, it's true. Like once this comes into your life, like there's no getting high the same. You know, I might get that much relief. You know, and it used to last all day. And so I went back out for a while, and then I realized, like, well, shit, maybe it's the substance, right? You know, heroin, that's bad shit, you know? Meth, I could probably manage. I could probably manage that. And I will say, meth did get me off heroin. For a period of time. It comes with a whole different set of problems. But it did work temporarily. And so, you know, I was introduced to meth. And once again, it was an economic decision, really. You know, it was Adderall. And then, you know, I could get into the technicalities of that, but it took me to a very, very dark place very, very, very quickly. I was on the run, you know, I was in drug court and I was on the run because I don't show up to court dates ever, you know, ever. I hadn't talked to my family in a long time. I was living in a trailer, with someone that did not want me there, basically. And, you know, I lose the car, I lose the girl, I lose all the shit. And I might have had, like, a little TIA, you know. But for the first time, this is significant, I was being told that I had to leave because the people that I was getting high with were not comfortable with the way I was getting high. You know, and so I got in the shower. I remember my roommate telling me, like, look, I'm going to work. You need to be gone when I get back. And I did not know what I was going to do. And so I got in the shower and I just broke down. You know, I'd been up for somewhere around 18 days and good one. And I got in the shower and I just broke down, and I said probably the first honest prayer that I've ever said in my life, and it was something real eloquent, like, God help me. And I'm sitting there, you know, snot's running, my skin's burning from all the shit, I'm sweating out, and I hear a knock on the door, and I get out of the shower, and I go to the door, and open it up, and my dad's there. And he did not know I was living there. He knew I'd stayed there, you know, from time to time. And I just kind of collapse on him, you know. And he said, son, are you ready to get some help? I said, yeah, I am. And so I went back to treatment. And that's significant because it's the first time my ass was properly whooped at the time. You know, it heals. But at the time, it was what I needed. It was what I needed. And so I... that was the first time I really came in and gave this a fair shot. You know, I got a sponsor. I worked some steps. And I had a profound experience. You know, I remember walking out of the first fifth step that I did, and it was like, holy shit. You know, that emotional block that I had, you know, that total lack of empathy or the ability to connect with another person, at that moment was gone. And really, it's never come back to the same extent. I have not been sober since then, but that has never come back. And what it did is it made me realize, like, this program works, you know. I was in another fellowship then, and there were a lot of young people that were getting sober. I got exposed to 12-step recovery, you know, somewhere around when I was 18, and because I had to go, you know, get a slip signed. And But I went to, you know, some other fellowships of people that I could not relate to at the time. I didn't know any junkies that were sober, you know. And so this time around, I came in and I saw people that were talking about shooting dope with toilet water, you know. And I'm like, hell yeah, that's my people, you know. And, you know, it worked and things got good. And that was bad, you know. One of those. That's the story of my life for a lot of my life, is that when I come in here, I'm real willing and I want to do whatever I got to do. And I'm like, God, help me. And then God helps me. And I'm like, appreciate it. I got it from here. And that's what happened. You know, I had taken a hostage for a while, for a couple years at this point, and she was not a drug addict when we got together, but she was when we broke up. And so I had gotten clean and things were real good, and you know, and I started getting high again, and you know, it's like, hey, let's do this, you know. And so we get real, real, real strung out, and I love this girl. I still love her in a way. And so we get real strung out. And for whatever reason, this is the only time in my life I've ever done this. I will never do it again. I decided to go through her phone. Right? Yeah. Yeah. And what I found... was that this girl that I'd been with for about 3.5 years at this point, you know, was prostituting herself and had been for a while. And I remember she was asleep, and I woke her up, you know, calling her everything but a child of God. And and a couple hours later, I'm like, you know, we're about to be sick. You probably need to call one of those guys. And that went on for a while. You know, I remember driving to hotels and sitting in the car, knowing what's going on inside. You know, and it wasn't because I didn't love that girl. You know, it was because I was being driven by something that I had no control over. You know, and I realized that heroin was the most important thing in my life, ahead of my family, ahead of this, you know, my partner, ahead of my friends, ahead of my dreams and hopes and aspirations and all of these things. And yeah, that was another one of those pivotal moments. You know, I had to process that for a long time. I still have some guilt and shame about that. I'd be lying if I said I didn't, because I actively participated in that. I encouraged it. And so, you know, the next couple years went on like they do. You know, I've put together some time and then I lose it. You know, life gets bad. I do what I need to do. Life gets good. I fuck it up again. And so this time around, I put together about 17 months a few years back. And then I went out for about 3.5 years. In the process of that, I've literally ran across the country. The last time I was in sober living, I ran into this guy that had known me for a while, and he said something very profound to me. He said, you know, I realized something about you, Anthony. He said, you don't give a fuck about being homeless. Like, you know, I think you're right. My decisions would indicate that that is the truth. And, you know, because I didn't really go into that, but that's a big part of my story. You know, I ended up on the streets the first time at 20, and I spent a lot of time out there until I got sober this time around. Part of that, you know, at one point I'm like, well, you know, I really think the state of Alabama is my problem, which I'm not convinced that it's not, but I'm going to go as far as I possibly can. And so there were drugs involved. I was kind of sleep deprived when I made this decision, but I went down to the Greyhound bus station and I bought a ticket to Los Angeles, and, we'll figure it out, you know. And that was an extravaganza. I got stranded in Texas, in Amarillo, Texas. Horrible place. For about 2 days. And, you know, my luggage gets lost. I end up in a hospital. Eventually, I make it to L.A. With the clothes on my back, a little bit of money, and a little bit of dope in my pocket. And I walked out of that bus station right into Skid Row. And I didn't leave for 7 months. And I did a lot of things out there that I'm not proud of. I Earl H. talks about getting high without anchors. And I experienced that. Because there was always, even when I was running around and I wasn't talking to people and all that, like, I always knew, like, somebody was there, you know. I could go show up at Jaffe, you know, somebody will give me a cigarette and buy me a cup of coffee, you know, like, I can call, you know, somebody. And I got out there and I didn't have that. And it got real dark, you know. I got caught in this cycle of just go, steal, sell, cop, do dope, repeat, you know, sleep on the fucking, the air vents in the wintertime because it blows hot, you know. My family bought me tickets to come back 3 different times. The first 2 times I had every intention of leaving. The problem was I had to walk across Skid Row to get to the bus station. And every time, you know, something would come up, you know. I never smoked crack till I went to California. It was, yeah, I just couldn't break out of it. You know, eventually I did end up making it back, and I wish I could tell you that I got here and I'm like, that was a mistake, I got to get sober. That's not what happened. You know, I got back, I did the same shit in Birmingham again. I lived up under the bridge up there by Vulcan for months. Months. I would push my bike up the hill. At night when I was high, because I knew I would wake up dope sick in the morning and I could just coast all the way down into Southtown. So eventually, that's pretty smart, yeah. But like, dope at this point had not been working for a very long time. You know, it was just all I knew, really. Because the problem is, and I've realized this, when I get out there, I can convince myself, even though I know this program works, when I get out there on this that shit, I can convince myself that it doesn't. And I can convince myself that all y'all are full of shit. And, you know, maybe I didn't know what I thought I knew. You know, I'm probably the only one that's right. That's like my natural state of being. But I just didn't know how to break out of that cycle. And, you know, we talk about surrender in here. My sponsor always likes to point out, and I agree with him, that I don't think we surrender. I think we get surrendered. And that was a long, long process for me. You know, it wasn't a white light moment. It was a lot of experiences leading up to, you know, what I hope was my last shot of dope. You know, one of those experiences, I was smoking crack with my fellow homeless associates, and I took a big old blast, and it, one of those thoughts entered my consciousness, like, what are the odds that you're the only one that's right and all these other people are wrong? Really fucked up my high, you know. bad. But it was one of those things, like, I look at that as one of those turning points for me. And I didn't stop getting high that day. In fact, I really needed to get high after that one, you know. But it started this train of thought that eventually, like, culminated into something else. And, you know, I found myself getting high thinking about being sober. You know, and the last run that I went on wasn't very long, but it was pretty bad. I didn't look real good when I got here. And I was sitting on a couch once again in an apartment where a bunch of people were getting high, and they didn't like the way I was getting high. You know, I was a liability. And and I had been sober. I had put together a little bit of time before that. And I'd been getting high for about 16 days. And I just couldn't do it anymore. You know, not only like not just getting high, but like I was so fucking tired of building my life up and tearing it down, and building it up and tearing it down, and getting close to people and then ripping them away, you know, and hurting them and doing all this stuff. And so I was just like, I was just going to kill myself. That's probably the only time in my life where I really, that seemed like the best option. And I had some dope and I had a little bit of money. I thought I was doing all right. And I was staying at a friend of mine's house that she had like an open DHR case. And she's like, you got to get out of here. And I'd just been in treatment earlier that year. And I'm like, I can't fucking do it again. Like, I've done it 14 times. Like, it's not going to work. This is just prolonging the inevitable. And so I was trying to figure out how I could kill myself. One, somewhere where nobody would find me in time to Narcan me, because I hate that shit. I mean, I'm grateful for it, but, you know. And two, where it wouldn't affect my friend getting her daughter back. And so I'm sitting there trying to figure out, like, the logistics of that. And I get a phone call. And I didn't have the number saved, or I wouldn't have answered. But I did answer it, and it was a friend of mine that worked at this treatment center. And he said, how you doing? I said, well, I've been better. And he said, well, you think you want to go back to treatment? And I'm thinking, fuck no. I don't want to go back to treatment. But what came out of my mouth was, yes, please come get me. And I was in treatment 20 minutes later. And that started this experience that I'm having now. I laid in that detox bed and I prayed to die, you know, for a few days. And then I realized I'm probably not going to die. And so I'd been around here long enough to realize that, like, I knew that this was a spiritual program. You know, I'd met people, some people in this room that I knew how they were and I know how they are now. And I knew that that wasn't them. You know, that something else was involved in that. And so I was like, I got to figure this out. You know, I got to figure God out, right? But I knew, like I said, I had grown up in a very religious household. But I understood in that moment that I didn't have any personal experience with a higher power. I had a bunch of information, you know, and I kept getting high. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, it was another one of those experiences. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I don't know what I think I know. And, but I, for whatever reason, I just realized that this was something that I needed to put time into. You know, I needed to put effort and intention into. And so I started doing that. I had worked the steps multiple times at this point. And I realized that that by itself was not going to work. You know, there's a part in the book where it talks about, you know, a better code of morals or philosophy in life was insufficient. You know, and for me, 12 steps without God, that's what it is. That's what it is. I can use it as a tool to manage my life. I can get some insight into how my mind works, but I don't have the power to change any of it. You know, I'm just aware, which is even worse. It's even worse. I'm telling you, you want to fuck up getting high, do a 4-step, you know, and then go out there and do some more of that shit. So I really, really dug into that, and I started saying a lot of, you know, a lot of prayers. And it was something along the lines of, God, if this is going to happen, you got to do it. You got to do it because I can't. You know, this is the best I got. I can't. And, you know, there's another part where it talks about God doesn't make too hard of terms for those who earnestly seek him. And that was the first time in my life that I could say I was earnestly seeking. You know, and it wasn't because, you know, my family took me to church. It wasn't because, like, you know, I cared what anybody thought. It's because I didn't want to keep living the way that I was going to live, you know, that I'd been living. And I probably wasn't going to die anytime soon. Like, fuck. So I got to figure this shit out, me and God, you know. And so I started getting up early in the morning. I would read things. I would watch the sunrise. You know, I've shared, a bunch of y'all have heard this before, but I'll say it again. You know, I viewed the sunrise every morning as God's gift to me. You know, all I had to do was make sure my sorry ass was out of bed to see it. You know, and I did that. For the first 7, 8, 9 months I was sober, I did not miss the sunrise. And something started happening. You know, I can't explain it. You know, this is all stuff that you've got to experience it on your own. Like, I can tell you what it was like for me, but you can't understand. You know, you might be able to relate, but you can't understand it. None of us can. But something started to happen. And I was out of plans. You know, for the first time in my life, I was out of plans. You know, I was in treatment, didn't know what I was going to do when I got out of treatment. Really, you know, wasn't in a big hurry to find out. You know, I'm going to get out again, get some bullshit job I hate, you know, pay some bills I don't want to pay. You know, like, what am I in a hurry to get back to? And I realized, like, literally all I have to do is stay sober. I don't know why I knew that, but I knew that. Like, literally all I have to do is stay sober. And that means having a relationship with God for me. And so I got the privilege of, I went through that treatment center, and I got the privilege of staying on and working there. And I'm so grateful for that. I really, really am. Mainly because it allowed me, it gave me this space in my life to put recovery where it needed to be. You know, because I'd never been able to do that. Like, when I'm worried about the job and when everything's going on, like these worldly clamors, the book talks about, I lose sight of that. And, you know, I fell in love with this program. I really, really did. You know, and I got thrust into sponsorship early on. And I did not feel qualified at all to do that. I still don't sometimes. But it was like, hey, this is what you're doing, you know? And I experienced, you know, a lot of those why questions, because I'd always felt like I'd been dealt kind of a bad hand in life. I don't feel that way today, but that's something that had been with me for a long time. And I sat down with a guy and did a fifth step, listened to his fifth step, and it was like he was reading my inventory, you know? And I realized, like, that's why. That's why all this stuff happened. Because there's somebody out there that's going through the same thing. The same thing. And it made me buy in. You know? I've had so many experiences. I've had experiences with every part of this program that have made me buy in. You know? Because it was a blind faith when I started this thing. I didn't have any evidence. Or I couldn't see it. There was evidence, but I couldn't see it. Until I saw it. And now, like, I see the results of this program. So I know I'm running out of time. I want to tell this one story. So my dad was very, very, you know, we were close. We were close. Not as close as I would have liked to have been, but we were close. And he got diagnosed with cancer in 2018. Okay. Oh, by the way... like minutes on the clock. My sobriety date is September 15th, 2021. So I got sober then, and he was terminal at the time. And I realized, like, I had walked away from that relationship, and I tried to be there the best that I could. You know, I understood that, like, there wasn't a lot of time, right? And I knew that, like, that was a reservation that I'd had for a long time. It's like, if my dad dies, I won't have any reason to stay sober. You know, I really, really believe that. But that started to change. I'm like, no, I want this thing. I really do. And so I did what y'all taught me to do. I reached out to people in the program that had lost parents. And, you know, said, what do I need to do to walk through this sober? And that's how I got, you know, that's how I started interacting with my sponsor now, as I'd heard his story about how, you know, his dad had cancer and he took care of him the last months of his life. And so it started this dialogue. And the first thing that he said was like, well, have you made amends to him? I said, no. He's like, well, that's probably a good place to start. And so I did that. I went to him and I made, you know, gave him my little pitch, and it wasn't the experience that I expected it to be. You know, it was a what I would expect, probably a pretty typical father-son situation. You know, yeah, I love you, I forgive you, keep doing what you're doing. You know, and I walked away. I was like, damn, yeah, I'll be more than that. Well, a couple weeks go by, and hospice gets called in, and I get a call like, hey, you need to be here. And so I go. You know, that's something that I was not able to do when I was getting high. I didn't make it home for a family Christmas for 5 years, you know. But I was able to go there and show up. And I walked in because I wanted to be with my dad, you know, and I wanted to be with my family as, you know, we were all going through this. And my brother was there. And we had had a contentious relationship, to say the least. He's a frustratingly good guy, you know. He couldn't relate to what I was doing. And I walked in there, and I saw him there by my dad's bed, and I was just overwhelmed with this sense of gratitude, because I had walked away from that family years ago, you know. And at this point, my dad had been battling cancer for 3 years, you know, and I was there the last 5 months. And I realized, like, all that time that I'd been out there running and gunning and doing what I was doing, like, my family had been there. You know, they had been picking up the slack. My dad was not alone. And I just, it came over me, you know, and I made amends to my brother at the foot of my dad's deathbed, you know. I said, I'm sorry for walking away. I'm sorry for leaving you with all of this, for not taking responsibility for the part of the family that I am, you know. And can you forgive me? What can I do to make it right? You know, and I made that amends. And my dad had, the cancer had metastasized to his brain, and he had over 100 tumors in his brain at the end. He was in and out a lot. And, you know, so me and my brother are talking, and you know, we're crying and hugging and all that, and turn around, and my dad is just as clear-eyed as you and me, you know, and he's watching that whole thing. And I went and I sat down next to his bed, and he got up and he put his arm around me, and we sat there for a while, and then he took his arm off and he rolled over and he went to sleep and he never woke up. You know? That's what this program gives me. I'm able to be there when I was not able to be there. You know, I was able to be there for my family as they planned the funeral. You know, I was able to take my stepmom to surgeries, you know, after he died. I still talk, you know, I have relationships today. You know, what I talked about at the very beginning about that inability to have a partnership with another human being, that is not true for me today. And it started with y'all. I had to come here to learn how to be in a family. You know, and y'all were there for me. You know, when my family said, no, we love you, but you can't come here. I'm very, very grateful. You know, I'm honored for this opportunity, because this is not something that a guy like me does. You know, there's some people in here that know me for a while. Like, this ain't what I do. You know, usually if you see me, it's out of the corner of your eye. But I'm very, very grateful for this opportunity. And I'm grateful for all of y'all, you know, for being here. This thing works, man. You know, try it. Try it. get a relationship with God. You know, I promise you, like, it's worth it. That's all I got.
I looked around, and I don't think there is a dry eye in the room. All right, we don't have dues or fees, but we do have expenses. We are completely self-supporting by our own contributions. Please observe the seventh tradition as the baskets are eating. If you need to purchase a big book, please see our literature chair. Would the literature chair please raise your hand? Please respect the facility by cleaning up after yourself and making sure all cigarette butts find their way to the ashtrays. Ashtrays are located outside the main entrance. Are there any announcements from the secretary? I'm Sydney, I'm an addict. If anyone would like to get plugged in with H&I Opportunities, if you guys can see Frank up here at the end of the meeting. And then after the meeting, if we could get some help getting the chairs put up, we're going to stack the chairs on this side up against the wall and put these in a circle around the room. And I think there's some chairs in the youth back in rooms at tables. Are there any other CA or recovery related announcements?
Dylan, drug addict.
Hey, Dylan.
For those of y'all that are not aware, CA World is in Atlanta. I actually have dates this time.
Whoop, whoop.
The 25th through the 29th. If you're interested, give it to Boyd, and I'll show you how to register and get your hotel and all that.
Thanks, Dylan.
Frank, have a good one.
Hi, Frank.
If anybody has background for Department of Corrections, please get them back to me tonight or next week, or send me a direct message and I can email them to you. Thank you.
Perfect.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Rebecca. Thank you. Anyone else? All right. If you'd like to make the Wall Big Book group your home group, please get with the home group member after the meeting or join us at our monthly group conscience, which is held at 6 p.m. on the first Tuesday, which is this next Tuesday at 6. Would all home group members please raise your hand? We hand out key tags and medallions to designate our time clean and sober. Tonight, I've asked Joe to hand out the milestones.
Hey, I'm Joe. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Joe.
Here at the Wall CA, we use key tags to denote various lengths of sobriety. That is continuous sobriety. And the first one we offer is the white one, which is just a surrender chip to join or rejoin this way of life. Anybody?
Yeah.
Anybody else?
All right.
Days, 1 month.
Y'all stop.
that.
Six years? 7 years? 9 years? 10 to 20? 20 to 25? 25 to life? No? Well, I have the great honor of giving out a chip tonight to a very special person. I've already got the chip, so I don't need it actually. I was going to think about what I was going to say, but man, how could I? Thank you, man. Appreciate that. I met this guy when I was in sober living in 2018, and I was being sponsored by somebody else at the time, Tommy H., big old guy with a big old personality, and he got sick and he couldn't sponsor me anymore, or he was about to get surgery. He was like, hey, man, I got this guy, you know, I want him to work with you. And I looked at this guy, and I was like, this guy says things like, oh, it doesn't work if you work it. It works when you work it. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, man, there must be some mistake, Tommy. You know, I'm not so sure about this. And, I was going into the fifth step when we started together, and I had no choice but to completely abandon myself to this guy and immediately get to know him in an intimate way. And we haven't really stopped since. You know, there have been ups and downs for sure. And when I went back out and got too good to talk to him and all that, and then wasn't too good to talk to him. And I was literally at the jumping off place. And first thing I did was I called Thomas. And he didn't say, go, you need to do this now. Or, none of that stuff. It was just, what are you going to do, Joe? What are you going to do? Always in the solution. This guy lives it. Depth and weight. He's a really good guy, you know. We live together now, and every single day we pray together. Every single day we meditate together. Every single day we confess our faults to each other. Every single day we pray for each other. And I don't know what I'd do without him. Who's got 8 years?
Can we give Anthony another round of applause? Yeah. Thank you, brother. That was real. I don't know if I can hold a candle to that for real, but how'd I do it? Man, like y'all said, I don't know. For real. I came in here and I was surrounded by men who had known a spiritual experience, and I was broken. And they loved me in a way that put some pieces back together long enough for me to hear what they were saying. And it was such an attractive way of life, something I had never knew or understood before until I began living it. And I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as we understood Him, most like you guys. I made a commitment to dedicate myself to this program in service to you. And it was through that process that things were revealed about me. Not just all the bad things, but some attributes that I could hold on to that could help me to connect with and develop relationships, much like I'd never done before, just like you. And those relationships have given me the strength to stick around so I could develop a relationship with that God we talk about. And it's made all the difference. Any reconsiderations on the white chip?
Yeah.
Oh, come on now. Anybody else? All right, give God a hand, the chips you hold.
All right, if anyone here is willing and able to sponsor, would you please raise your hand? If you're looking for a sponsor, anyone with their hand raised is a good place to start. If you would like further assistance in finding a sponsor, please come up to the podium after the meeting. And I've asked a friend to read the 10th step promises and take us out with the we version of the Serenity Prayer.
I'm Angie, I'm an addict. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even cocaine and all mind-altering substances, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in drugs or alcohol. If tempted, we recoil from them as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward drugs and alcohol has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. All right, new version. God.
To accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Woo! It's so beautiful. Thank you.